Welcome to Day Zero Update for April 28th, 2024. I'm your host, Chris Elogi.
I'm Brandon Perkins.
And I'm Dan Rib Victoria.
And yeah, we've got a decent week of news here for this week.
Yep.
Nothing really amazing here happened. But we did have some Embracer Group news.
Yep.
Where they are changing their names again.
Yep.
Tell you about that and the whole weird thing that's going on there.
Yeah.
We got a long lost publisher returning. That you probably never expected to hear again, but they're coming back. I guess. We got an event coming up that was supposed to happen this year that has been canceled. As well as a showcase happening later this week. And a couple more things on subscription news. So yeah, we'll get to that stuff here a little bit later.
Yeah.
But before then, we'll talk about what we've been playing. And I'll kick it off here. The big thing I've been playing is Tales of Kinzera Zal. We'll talk a little bit more about that later.
Yeah.
Because we've all been playing it, so we'll talk about that here at the end. But yeah, also been playing some stuff that's been on Game Pass, another Crab's Treasure, which has been fun so far. I put about an hour or two into it so far. It's got an interesting beginning part of the game because it's very different from the demo that I played last year, I think it was, where basically your little hermit crab has found out that the area, I guess, has a new duchess that is has raised taxes that they didn't know they that existed. So their home, aka the shell on their back, has been taken by a loan shark that is basically one of those like grabber things, but you know, a shark's head on it is used to grab the shell off his back. And as you're chasing around, that's sort of your tutorial for a lot of your platforming abilities. And then you get a last little sequence where you go diving into the water. That is a pretty neat little sequence as you sort of get into the sea and then start dealing with some of the weird stuff that's happened, I guess, where all these other crabs sort of have something going on that causes them to attack you. And so as you kind of land in this area, you kind of talk to somebody and they're like, oh, you're going to have to go talk to the Duchess. And there's a big giant castle, sand castle under the sea that you're heading towards. And as you're going there, you're fighting enemies, very Souls-ish kind of thing, but not really too technical on that front. You do have a dodge and all that kind of stuff, a dodge roll, and that stuff all works pretty well. But yeah, your bonfires are more these warm spots that are where you kind of set up a little, almost like a house that you might put in like an aquarium kind of thing. Like one of those to set up where you can use some of the currency you get to upgrade your stats. You know, as you upgrade one, the next one gets more expensive, that kind of thing. So you're very much paying attention. I think it's just four stats. There's health, there's attack, there's like a resistance stat for, I assume, some like elemental things that are going on. And then there's the last one that's, I forget what that is. I think it's for some other ability, but yeah, early on, you're probably going to upgrade your health and your attack stuff. But once you get to the castle, they send you off to the side to, you know, get dressed essentially because you don't have a shell. So you're essentially naked. And so you go off to the side and then you find a big, pop machine that's been, you know, sunk at the ground and, into the ocean and you hit the button to pop out a bunch of cans. And that's where you get your first big boss fight, against, a night crab that, is very ridiculous and silly. Cause he's just constantly yelling about you being a lawbreaker and very much an all caps, kind of caption person there. As you're dodging attacks, it took me a good bit to beat it as I kind of understood more of the way the mechanics work, where essentially you're putting these like pop cans on your on yourself as your shell, and you essentially want to hide in it when they're going to attack. At least this boss character is. Otherwise, you're going to lose like a good at least a third or maybe a half of your health depending on the attack. And let the shell take all the damage because there's, you know, four or five that pop out. So you got some of that. But yeah, when you die, at least on this stuff, you come back in the same area. So you don't necessarily have to do like a run, but you do have your currency left behind. So you have to pick that up, but it's not like left exactly where you died. It's just left where you spawn. So it kind of is a lot more friendly with that stuff. But they also have an assist menu where you can mess with a lot of other mechanics to make it an easier game if you need that. So it has a pretty friendly kind of accessibility system to it. So that game so far has been pretty fun. It's very silly, and a lot of it's story and presentation stuff. So I'm definitely looking forward to playing some more of that. But yeah, put about an hour or two into it, so not too much so far. But that is on everything, I believe. But it's also on Game Pass on Xbox and PC. So you can check it out there.
Mm-hmm.
The other game I've been playing, a few hours of Ayudin Chronicle 100 Heroes.
Mm-hmm.
This is the main game in the series, which we got Rising last year or 2 years ago. I forget
mm-hmm.
when that was. But this is the more proper JRPG, especially in the Suikoden mold.
Mm-hmm.
I played through the intro on this. It takes a couple hours to get through. You get a big intro where your main character, Noah, has shown up in this village from his village and has joined the Watch, which is sort of the keepers of this village, but I guess this is associated with the group known as the League of Nations.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's also the Empire. That for at least this intro kind of comes together to try to find the primal lens, which if you played Rising, you know about the lenses, the runes lenses. This is, I believe, what you were looking for all of Rising before stuff happens at the end that causes you to destroy it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, you're kind of starting with a full party of six. I think you can have 10 total, but I think there's a few slots there for support stuff. So I don't know what all that's about because I have not recruited enough people to do any of that.
Mm.
But you have two that are borrowed members, essentially from the Empire. So you can't equip anything on them or anything like that. But yeah, you're going through these dungeons. You do essentially two different dungeons. I guess they're linked together, but you go through a forest and then into the rune barrows, which you've seen that in Rising. So that's a similar concept, but with this being more of a JRPG versus like a 2.5D kind of action game, mm-hmm. that's a little bit of a different vibe to it all. And so, yeah, it has random battles, so you're just running around. You don't see enemies around, so you're just, after a certain period of time, you see, you know, a little visual effect that says, you know, oh, you're going into a fight. And from there, they let you pick if you're going to fight it or do the auto battle stuff, which they have a bunch of AI tools and settings to set up how your party members are supposed to act in a fight if you don't want to do it, or you can flee. Right away, so they kind of let you avoid battles, I guess. But
mm-hmm.
For this early part, I took part in all of them because it's kind of necessary because early on you're pretty vulnerable with how mm-hmm. much HP you have. You start with, you know, 20 to 30 HP, and so enemies could do a good half or more of that in damage if you let them. But yeah, it has the timeline, so you can see how your different attacks tie into that stuff. Affect that in good or bad ways. And they have a Chrono Trigger-esque kind of combo system so you can kind of link up with other heroes. So when they introduced that, it was against a boss, basically. So I had the two characters that had the hero combo were kind of just doing it over and over again every turn they had, which bumped one of the characters from attacking before the boss to attacking after. But yeah, the major knocks I have against this game is that the camera system in the dungeons is not great. The early forest dungeon you go through has a lot of these like vines that you're walking on as paths from one area to another, and you don't have camera control. So sometimes it can be hard to even see them or see where you're going. And you're probably looking to check out all the paths and look for, you know, chests or whatever else is hidden in some of these other paths. So that can be tough in some of these areas with having no control over that camera and the way it just kind of moves around as you're going around. So it kind of tries to almost keep you in a 2D view at times when you're just going on these like automated paths essentially, but it can just be a little bit of a very kind of poorly designed kind of camera system there. And so, yeah, that stuff was a little frustrating in that first dungeon, but once you get into the rune barrows themselves, that stuff is mostly fine there, because it's sort of set, you know, square rooms, and you're just going through these different areas, opening up doors when you can, that kind of stuff. And yeah, it's so far it's been pretty good. I've not gotten far enough to really have a great opinion of what it's doing either way, but the combat stuff seems pretty good. Though I don't have a sort of your skill attacks, your special attacks that are tied to this little meter that seems to fill up with each turn, but I've not been able to figure out necessarily how it's set up between battles. It feels like some characters would have skills they could use right away every fight, but then randomly in other fights not have it. And I'm just a little bit out of sync on that kind of stuff. They do pop up little tutorial things, so I probably need to go reread those and check them out and see if I missed something. But story-wise, yeah, the Empire is looking after this, looking for this primal lens. And spoilers, you find it in this tutorial sort of intro in the game. And so they kick it ahead once you get out of that 6 months. So you're kind of sitting as part of this watch where one of the members has kind of gone off on some mission. And you're kind of stuck with the three others that are left behind. And where I'm at right now is like, oh, you need to go recruit people. And that's where I kind of stopped, because I'm like, okay, I'll do that another time. And when I've tried to jump in and try to figure it out, it's got a lot more time, I assume, needed for the next thing. Because it's like where you're at this town and you can go to the shops and get your equipment and all that kind of stuff. So that's kind of the slow and boring part of JRPGs, where you're kind of just getting going with this stuff, especially when you're playing a Suikoden style game where you're going to have tons of people to recruit. So I'm at the part where I have three people in my party. It's three of the four that you start with in the watch, and we're just kind of going around talking to people. That's about it for that. So there's that. That's on everything, but also on Game Pass for Xbox and PC. From what I've heard, the Switch version is the roughest version, which is maybe not too surprising for what it's doing here. So there's that. And then the last game, PuzzMix. This is an Indie Creates game. They released it on Switch and maybe Steam earlier this month, but I put it out on PlayStation and Xbox here at the end of the month. This is a Suica kind of game, the fruit-dropping puzzle game that's been a big deal on the Switch. They've decided to make their own version of that, but instead of fruit, it's these round robots, essentially. And so there's different, 12 different designs. And so you're wanting to get the like ones matched together, and then they turn into the next form and try to, you know, match those together to kind of keep getting these increasingly large, robots. And they have different designs. The big difference here is that those robots often have sort of sharp points to them on some of their designs, so they don't necessarily roll around a bunch. So you kind of have parts of these where you can get some of the robots dropped onto the pointy parts, and they kind of get stuck there in a way. So you're kind of dealing with those not allowing, you know, a lot of the shuffling around that the typical kind of Suika game ends up feeling like. So, but yeah, this one does a good job with that stuff. The I guess the big thing is that they have a bunch of songs in this, so you're unlocking every so often songs, and there's like maybe 12 or 15 in there, but I'm usually not playing with the audio on, so I don't really hear much of it. So, but they do have a pretty simple trophy list for this game, which a handful of them are just like, look at the song list when you've unlocked 5, you look at the song list when you've unlocked 10, and look at the song list after you've unlocked them all. And a few for the score, and a few for doing some different things. You know, one for dying your first time, which the way that the end of the round happens is kind of a bit weird. So you have a line at the top of the screen where your little robots are piling up to, and if any part of a robot crosses that line, it starts a countdown from 5 to 1. And when it's, if you can't get it out of there, with the general notion that there's a lot of pointy parts of this that kind of keeps that from happening, you're generally going to have that be the end of your run. The only other thing I've seen is occasionally when two robots merge, they kind of cause a little explosion of sorts and kind of shoot the rest of them around. I've had them shoot them off the screen, which it stops counting at that point. It seems to only care about the line being touched. So I went and shot some of the little ones like way up off the screen. That take a little bit to fall back down. It's like, oh, maybe if they were thinking about this, they would have made that start a counter, but luckily they don't, because some of them have taken a little longer than I would have thought. But so far that's been pretty good. That's like a $4 game, so nothing really too major to the cost of that. So that's definitely one to check out if you're looking for a Suika game that's a little bit different. So, but that's been pretty much all I've been playing. So, Brandon, what have you been doing?
Well, as for me, I am playing Tales of Kinzaro Zal, but we'll talk about that a little later. I have been spending a lot of time playing Helldivers 2, and I'll just say it right now, that game is definitely going to be on my game of the year list once December rolls around, because I genuinely love it. It is a lot of fun, and I learned to just embrace the chaos, and it works. It's an amazing game with just a lot of neat little features that continue to surprise you. I have, having spent time sort of fighting both of the major factions, I've come to realize that both of them definitely approach combat differently. The Terminids, you know, the bugs, they are not terribly intelligent. They're mostly like, their biggest thing is that they can basically Zerg rush you. But considering the fact that they can basically spawn basically anywhere, because, you know, they're basically underground and they can just break open underground, break open a hole, and then just suddenly start spewing out at you, until you, you know, throw a grenade in and close the hole. They can overwhelm you very quickly. It's very easy to find yourself getting just completely mobbed by them. But the difference between them and the automatons is the automatons are actually surprisingly intelligent. For one thing, as you would expect for, you know, this being a major war and a battlefield, the automatons actually invest heavily in long-range artillery. It is, you know, it is not unusual to just see a red laser bullet from one of their guns just seemingly just fire the whole distance just out of nowhere and plant one right in the head. They are very smart, and they are much more varied in the way that they group up their troops and deliver them. Unlike the bugs that burst up from underground, the automatons have drop ships that will just rain enemies down. And these are enemies. They're everything from like the basic, you know, humanoid automatons to ones that ride, for lack of a better word, little mini AT-AT, not AT-ATs, the other one, the AT-ET or whatever they're called. And they even have tanks. They have automatons that have chainsaws for hands and shit like that. And they're all armored too, so it means that you can't just hit them with one bullet and expect them to go down. You have to actually, methodically like blast off limbs and parts of them. Some of them you have to specifically make a point of aiming at the torso so that the torso and the legs will disconnect and fall apart. And it can take like a whole clip from your gun to take just one of them down. So, you know, it requires some serious artillery on your part. And fortunately, the game does give you like a crap ton of heavy artillery. But the thing is, the game does not have friendly fire switched off. Friendly fire is always on, and it's very easy to accidentally kill yourself or someone else if you're not careful. But that's also just kind of part of the fun. Embrace the chaos and, you know, do your part to spread managed democracy throughout the galaxy. But and I did finally decide, is like, you know, I'm at level 10 now. I might as well take a chance and try a mission on Malevolon Creek, which, I totally get the memes now. It's this misty jungle covered planet where it can be difficult to see ahead of you at times. And the automatons have this habit of like dropping drop ships into like the heaviest parts of the jungle, so you never see them coming. You can only hear them, their weird little robotic marching chant that they have. So yeah, I get the memes. And other than that, I've also been playing Dave the Diver, and I know other of you have played this. I don't really have to talk about it as much. You're a dude named Dave. He's a pro diver. You work for a dude who's got like a sushi restaurant, and you're going down there and getting, you know, as many fish as you can, but you're also like picking up stuff that's fallen into the ocean so that you can, you know, give it back for orders and stuff like that and side quests and shit like that. And that's Dave the Diver. And that's basically what I've been playing. So Dan Reb, what about you?
Yeah. Main game, talk about it a little bit. I also started Sandland. Sandland came out on Friday. It is the video game adaptation of an anime that was adapted last year after Akira Toriyama wrote the manga, I believe, in 2000. So yeah, it's a little bit up there in age, but it's still after Dragon Ball. So, you know, a lot of similarities exist for it. The anime movie came out last year, and then the anime TV show came out a few weeks ago. And that one's still ongoing, and I've been enjoying that anime. But anyway, the thing is here with the anime TV show, the first few episodes actually cover the movie, and then this game pretty much covers the movie and then some. So I'm not beyond what's been shown on TV yet, pretty much in that same area. So it's pretty cool seeing how similar everything is. The anime TV show is better animated than the movie. And then like the video game is really, really close, and there's a lot of similarities, but of course it's a little bit different. And, you know, Bandai Namco is notorious for pretty much making whatever anime into a video game. So as great as the game looks, like, you know, I've already seen it being done better, whether it be through Dragon Quest XI or one of the Naruto games or one of the Dragon Ball Z games of the past. Like, yeah, it looks good, and this is what you expect out of Bandai Namco. The main thing here is that it's sort of open world, but it's still, you know, there's still a guided path there. It's still pretty linear and straightforward. The main thing, though, is that it's not I wouldn't call it a standard RPG. It's definitely more action-based, but from what I've played so far, levels don't really seem to matter much because if you wanted to, you can take out bigger enemies, but, you know, it has to make sense first. But yeah, so for those of you unfamiliar with Sandland, again, it was first written in 2000, and basically it takes place a few years after The war pretty much took away all of the world's water. And as a result, like, water is a very scarce resource. So what happens is, it's a very sandy undertaking. It looks very much similar to Dune. And you come across these goblins or demons. And they're led by this kid demon or the prince called Beelzebub. And he has, like, you know, he has, like, some martial arts powers very similar to what you see on Dragon Ball. But he's also a pretty kind-hearted. During the beginning of the game, he, you know, steals water from the police or the military and then gives some to a kid. And then all of a sudden, this has this guy named General Rao come around to try to recruit Beelzebub and the demons in order to find, like, the spring. And this spring or this source of water is actually being controlled by pretty much the aristocracy in the game or in the show. And yeah, basically you want to just make Sandland not the sad place it is anymore. And I'm not too far into it. I've only played for about 2 hours, but I'm looking forward to playing the rest of the game. And then now we get to Tales of Kinzera. This game came out, I believe it was last Tuesday or last Wednesday, one of those. And I've been playing it through PlayStation Plus Extra. This game is done in part or helped published by EA Originals. And this game follows this shaman named Zhao, who loses his father and then tries to, work with, like, the spirits in order to bring him back. And the game, at its core, is a Metroidvania. So, you know, when it comes to indie games, like, Metroidvanias are pretty common, but this is one that definitely enveloped me. As far as how far I am in the game, I finished it, I platinumed it, I did everything there is to do, and it only took me about maybe 6 hours. Granted, there are some hard parts. Some bosses are pretty hard, and I actually did bump the game down to easy to get through a few parts. But yeah, like, everything from the pacing to the storytelling to the acting is all pretty top notch here. You know, you pretty much have what you expect out of any Metroidvania, but you have some cool stuff right at the start. You have a double jump that's available. You don't have to unlock it. You can wall jump with the double jump to make the platforming a whole lot more fun. As far as attacking goes, you have two kinds of attacks. You have moon attacks and then you have sun attacks. Moon is pretty much just projectile stuff, so you can go ahead and shoot from there, but, like, you can't just, like, always be shooting like Samus. There is sort of a timing meter there where you run out after a while, then you have to wait for it to come back. But there is this, like, golf meter mechanism where if you time it just right, you can go ahead and continue shooting. So that's a pretty cool mechanic. And then as for the sun attacks, these are your melee strikes. So, you know, compared to something like Prince of Persia, which came out earlier in the year, these are your sword strikes. And, you know, you want to be able to mix them up depending on the enemy you go against. So if you're going against flying enemies, you want to use your projectiles. If you're going against, other sword fighters, you want to be able to use your melee strikes. And then sometimes they're more easy. Like, they'll be marked with red or blue to, you know, show what their weakness is, and you can go ahead and go from there. So the combat is really fun. It's really involved. I already talked about the platforming. And then as for the Metroidvania part, you know, obviously these games are notorious for backtracking in order to, like, find all the secrets. And yeah, this game still does that, but it's not there. It's not really required. Like, for example, if you finished one part, you can go ahead and warp somewhere else to go ahead and get closer to where you need to be. And while, you know, you can go ahead and backtrack the long way in order to find some secrets, they aren't really, like, required. The main thing is that you'll find, like, certain objects that allow you to learn more about the lore, or maybe you'll get an upgrade to your health. But, you know, these things are few and far between, and they aren't too strenuous. The main thing that I found annoying is after I finished, or not really finished, but before I fought the main boss, I wanted to, you know, find everything for the platinum, right? And the main thing that I found troublesome was the fact that while there is a fast travel system, you can only fast travel to other fast travel points. You can't fast travel to, like, you know, the place where you find, you know, the equal to the energy tank. You can't fast travel to any you've been before. You have to have unlocked a previous fast travel point. And that's pretty cumbersome because the map, while it's small, it's still pretty detailed, and there's still a lot of, like, different kind of obstacles to get to where you have to be. The game is definitely fun. I finished it. I did everything there is to do. So I'm interested in hearing what both of you
think. Well, first off, I just got to say, I love the framing story for it, because it makes the whole theme a lot more immediate. We all know that the creator of this game basically made it as sort of a tribute to his late father, and the game sort of makes that front and center. The whole sort of plot is that you're playing this young guy whose father has just passed away, and you're in the house with him. I'm guessing he's lying in state in like their bedroom or something, and he can't get himself to go in there. But his mother tells him that before he passed, he wrote this book down. I'm guessing like if this game ends up becoming like a franchise, this might be like sort of like how it's going to go. Like there's going to be like other books to take the stories from. And basically the story within a story is that you're playing a shaman who's, father was also a shaman, has also passed away, and he summons Kalunga, who is the Bantu god of death. And basically the whole idea is that there's these three spirits that have denied Kalunga and are still, you know, walking among the living. And the idea is if Zhao, which is the character you're playing, if he can convince those, more or less get those spirits to cross over to the other side, then Kalunga might agree to bring his father back from the dead. Now, you and I and everybody who hears us already knows that's not what's going to end up happening in the end. He's going to end up accepting death and everything. But the actual, like, one of the things I really like about this game is you're learning about, like, Bantu and Kenyan mythology and folklore as you play it. And, you know, all of the, like, various, the various enemies you come against, they're all based around, like, tribal masks and ceremonial masks. The character you play, Zhao, his primary, like, weapon of choice is a shamanistic mask. That has elements of both the sun and moon. So, you know, he switches between the two aspects, and they give him like different kinds of attacks. The moon gives him like mostly projectile attacks. The sun gives him mostly melee attacks. And then later on, as the game goes on, you get more different, you know, abilities to use to solve various puzzles and open gates and things like that. Other than that, the game also just looks gorgeous. It looks great. And it's, you know, like, I mean, I can't help it. Metroidvania is, you know, when they're done competently, is a very solid foundation for a game. And it definitely works here, you know. But I mean, that's about what I got. I've only finished like chapter one, so I still got a ways to go.
Yeah. I am in chapter two. I've met the person that was playing a horn,
mm-hmm.
Maybe about 5 hours in, so I'm definitely not speeding through this game in any way.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm liking a lot so far. Especially the first few hours, kind of not being super heavy on the combat, especially in the way that Prince of Persia is, gives it a really nice kind of chill vibe to it, mm-hmm. Where you know. Are focusing more on the platforming, and they can, you know, definitely do that because it's not, you have your double jump and your dash and your wall jump stuff unlocked pretty early, so you got a lot of free time to expound on that stuff. So you have like really, really wide areas to explore, and kind of they give you a lot of long jumps to do throughout this game, and it kind of gives this kind of a nice pacing to it that you don't often get in a lot of these kind of games that are just like, keep throwing enemies at them. We got to keep testing them constantly. But where I'm at, there's been a bit more of combat, especially in the getting some more combat rooms where they're throwing enemies at me. It took me a bit to basically that big elevator fight where I realized they were going to throw in elemental enemies. Because you only see the sort of shield texture on the health bar, at a certain point that I thought it was just a basic shield, but then I realized, oh, that was for ice enemies. And that was mostly what I was using, is the moon mask on that stuff. And yeah, where I'm at, there's red, there's blue, and which I don't think red ties into the sun mask so much, but they do go down more easily with that stuff. But that's kind of an interesting little wrinkle they add into it that kind of keeps you needing to switch, because for the first handful of hours, I've been mostly using the moon mask to shoot at enemies from a distance and never really having to get close up to them.
Yeah, I mean, when you're talking about the different power-ups you can use, they were definitely interesting. Like, you know, as we mentioned earlier, the platforming pretty much just gives you everything off the bat. Like, you know, later on, you know, hopefully this isn't too spoilers. I'm just talking about a gameplay aspect. Is you unlock another projectile with the sun that allows you to shoot at targets in order to activate electricity and open doors, and they'll be like open for a short amount of time, and you have to follow a spark through the cords in order to get to where you have to go. And yeah, those are timed, and you know they're timed because you want to be able to platform to where you have to. And on the ice side of it, you can do things like freeze water. So one of the cool things you can do in the game is, you know, sort of zap yourself to warp from one side of a waterfall to the other, but then you also get the ability to freeze it. And when you freeze it, what does that do? It creates another wall. So that wall allows you to just, you know, get up even further. So seeing as how you can combine, you know, your knowledge of all stuff to just get through the terrain makes it a whole lot more fun. Another one that I really like, you have the ability to sort of float. And then when you're floating, you want to avoid, obviously, like, you know, falling down on like spikies and things like that. But you also are in an area where there's wind from the bottom leading up, so it'll allow you to float and actually fly. So you want to be able to like do this properly, but at the same time, you know, avoid spikes that are in the ceilings. And then, you know, you want to be able to release the button, but then, you know, hold it as soon as possible, because both the floor and the ceilings are spiky, and you want to be able to control the speed. So, you know, using these aspects to, you know, go ahead and traverse to the different terrain is cool. And, you know, Chris mentioned the arena scenes, where if you look at the map, you can pretty much tell where there's going to be a big fight. Like, if you're in a big room, there's probably going to be a big fight there. And another thing is, you know, depending on where you want to go in the labyrinth, they have these challenges that are normally marked by triangles. And when you go ahead and take, not really take part, but it's pretty much just a platforming segment. And if you die at any time in this platforming segment, you have to go back to the very beginning of it. And normally at the end, they have something that'll just, those little balls that'll give you more power and buff. And like, yeah, I wouldn't say that they're all worth it, but you know, if you want to chase the platinum, those are some things you can do. And it really adds a lot of variety to the gameplay here, because for the most part, it's a pretty straightforward Metroidvania.
Yeah, though I would say the map design is very different in that you do not have very many kind of shortcuts to get back around. There's a lot of, not linear, but more straightforward pathing where the opportunities to get back to other areas is mainly through the fast travel. They do have a couple of shortcut areas in there, but not to the same extent that a lot of others in this genre do.
Yeah. And then like when you do unlock a shortcut, it's normally through a switch and it'll say shortcut unlocked. It helps in that regard.
Yeah. And it's a lot of that stuff that I like about this, where you're not for most of this game feeling like, oh, I don't know where I need to go next. There's so much, you know, space that, you know, it doesn't even block off the map for places you haven't been. You get to see huge chunks of it that you haven't been to. So you can be like, okay, this is an area that is self-contained. So there's probably a challenge thing or some collectible thing here that I should probably go do. So I can kind of be done with this area, that kind of thing. And I do like the challenges. They're all pretty well done that I've seen so far. A lot of platforming challenges. The toughest one I had is one that's in the forest area that is where you start seeing the sort of the spears shooting out of walls. Because I did not, through all the point up to this, I'd really never ducked. And so I did not really notice that you could do that until that point. And the only time I got past this one obstacle, purely because I dashed and it, I guess, put me in a crouch state by default because I kept trying to get through it. And it's like, well, do I have to get his head like between where the spikes would come out? And that's way too specific for this game. And I was like, can I crouch? And I tried it and I can crouch. Okay.
Yeah.
Is that kind of stuff that is pretty well done.
I think I totally cheesed that one because at the very end, or rather at the very start, you know, the exit to that challenge is literally right there at the start. And yeah, at the end you unlock a triple jump. So it makes it a whole lot easier. And I don't know if that was really intended, but yeah, you know, just, it's fun that allowed me to do that.
Mm. Yeah. Maybe the issues that I have so far is that there's a lot of control bugs.
Yeah.
If I am holding in the stick and I'm like, okay, where am I going to go in this map? Then I back out. I can't move until I
let
go with a stick and then push it back.
At any point when you pause, for some reason, you can't move left or right until after you jump, which was definitely annoying. It never killed me, but I definitely noticed that bug.
Yeah.
It's like it zeroes out your analog stick.
Yeah.
And you have to recenter it to start moving again.
And when I think about it, I guess that's another thing that bothered me. Like, to me, there's no reason why you can't use the D-pad in this game. You can't. So.
You can. You switch to it. It's an option.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
Yeah, it's one of the options. Like, do you want to use analog stick or D-pad? So it probably changes controls for the health stuff.
You can't use both.
No, because when you're using the stick, the up on the D-pad is for using your health. So I assume you use D-pad mainly. It probably does something with the stick to put your health in. Which I believe it also lets you remap most of the controls, so you can kind of do what you need with this. But yeah, it's that's the one main issue I've had. The other one is that I really wish you could use the right stick to move the camera around a little bit. So I feel like they designed a lot of obstacles that are like just outside of the view of where you're at. So like there's sometimes some jumps where it's like, okay, I'm pretty sure I got to go this way and there's going to be a platform there, but I don't want to, you know, start making jumps before I know what's going on. And they do make you do some blind jumps here and there from time to time. It's not a big deal, but it's definitely one where it's like, I do notice that if you walk your character up to a ledge, they put the camera down a little bit. So you can kind of see down some, but yeah, there's still a little bit of stuff like that. Cause all the time I end up walking off of ledges that don't necessarily read as ledges into spikes and killing myself a lot. But luckily this isn't the other brilliant thing they do here is that they do not have save rooms in this game. So if you die, you just respawn right near where you died. You can even quit out of the game and when you reload back into it,
you're
pretty much right where you were. So you don't necessarily have to go running back to save points and, you know, save scumming in that way that you do in a lot of games, so you can have a more freedom, more encouragement to explore and not worry about losing progress.
Mm-hmm.
That I think is an issue in a lot of these games in this genre.
Oh, yeah. And I think the creator specifically wanted these adjustments made. Like, these are actual, you know, things about these types of games he specifically hates. He's like, no, I don't want the player to have to go and backtrack all the way back to where they died from like a safe spot. That's a waste of time. Let's just have them spawn near where they died so that they can just go and do it again. So,
yeah. The only point they don't do that are on those challenge areas.
Yeah, but that makes sense.
Yeah, that's the challenge, is getting through the whole thing.
Yeah.
To which it's a surprise that there are things in some of those where they don't kill you right away.
Mm-hmm.
Because like some of the spike stuff they start shooting at you, it's like, oh, this didn't kill me. Okay, I'll just keep on. That's really easy.
Mm.
Oh yeah, the spikes that shoot at you can like kill you if you don't have enough extra life. But yeah, if you didn't, you know, upgrade at any point, then
yeah, and that stuff is pretty neat. And yeah, I am. What was the other thing I was noticing? Yeah, it's pretty easy up front for the most part on the normal difficulty, because I feel like I never went to very many combat scenarios where I felt like I was getting into trouble too much. The only times when they throw in Like that first elevator fight.
Yeah.
Where they have enemies on the sides of the screens, and if you dash through them, you're basically stuck between them and spikes. Mm-hmm. And so you take a bunch of hits that way. I feel like I dash a lot when I get into tight spots, as some of these fights are getting more tough. But like the bosses are all pretty easy. I was able to beat them, the two I've done so far, on the first try, or maybe the one bird boss. That one was pretty easy, even though I was like messing up a bunch. But as you do attacks, you fill up the health bars that you can use to refill your health and that stuff. It makes it pretty easy, especially because I think I had the trinket that when you take damage, it fills that up a bit more as well. So, but yeah, the trinket stuff is like the one weird mechanic that you can't do at any point in the game. You have to be at one of the little stations for that. But also the one I have is like the one that's most consequential for what I need, or just get some of that bar filled up so I can keep doing refilling health stuff. The poison enemies are kind of annoying, but not that much. Like I usually am trying to take those guys out fast. And yeah, even your shots on your moon form refill pretty quickly. And I've done the upgrades. So far, all my skill points have been going towards the moon mask so far. So I've not been spreading them around. I've got one in each of the tiers on that. So I don't know if I'm going to fill out the others on that side or go towards the sun mask, but the skill stuff works out pretty well for what it is. It's pretty slow early on because you're not fighting too much, but a lot of the side stuff, you get extra of the skill point XP for that. So yeah, it's a pretty well-paced game. It's not going to be, I don't think it's going to be like 20, 30 hours or anything like that. It's probably good 10 from where I am at in this game. So I'm definitely looking forward to put some more time into this. But yeah, the ability to kind of save wherever just makes it easier to pop in and out of the game and not have to worry about progress and being lost, since it puts on the map where you need to go. And so that also lets you know, like, okay, I'll be going this way. So these areas are the side areas. There's probably collectibles here. The only other knock I have with the collectibles, I wish you could do the audio logs. You could just play those as you're playing. I know it could probably cover up other dialogue with the characters that is going on, but I feel like that stuff could. In any game, they usually don't let you do that stuff, have it playing over gameplay. So, but yeah, that's pretty much all I really have to say about the game. But yeah, liking a lot so far. It's a $20 game, so it's not too expensive, especially compared to Prince of Persia that has a lot of meat to it and all that, but it's also a $50 game.
Yep.
But as an Ubisoft game, it'll probably be $20 by this summer.
Yep.
Here in the next couple of months. So if you're patient enough, you'll be able to get that in a pretty decent price.
Yeah. I mean, I've played a demo for Prince of Persia last year, but I haven't picked the game up yet just because of that reason. I've seen it at 30 at some places, but 20 is my sweet spot that I'm looking for. But yeah, just to, you know, help close things off, like, you know, the EA Originals initiative has been one that I've been proud of for a long time, even like before I worked there. I mean, like before I worked there, I was It Takes Two was my game of the year. And then, you know, while I was working there, they came out with, what was that one about the dice, Lost and Random. That was one that I liked a lot. I also liked Knockout City. So I'm pretty happy to see, you know, a game like Tales of Kinzera. Their main developer, his name is keeping me right now. It's really long, but yeah, he's sort of been doing a tour for the game and just talking about everything that he's been doing. You know, he's also I believe he was casted in House of the Dragon. So you know, it's not just game development he does. He shows that this is something that he's really proud of and that it's good. And yeah, like you mentioned, it's $20, so heck of a value. Again, it took me around 6-7 hours to complete, and that's not bad by any means. I didn't feel like I wasted my time at all. I had a really good time.
Yeah. But yeah, if you also don't want to pay directly for it, you can get it on PlayStation Plus for the extra and premium tiers. Mm. And I ended up paying for it myself to support the devs on that. So that's been pretty cool so far. So yeah, I think that'll end up doing it unless you have anything to add, Brandon.
Nope.
All right. Yeah, let's get to some news. And we got some subscription news for other subscriptions. For Nintendo Switch Online Plus Expansion Pack, the N64 app got two new games. Mm. We got Extreme G, the racing game, the sort of futuristic racing game. And then Iggy's Wrecking Balls,
mm-hmm.
which I guess is another racing game for that. So, yeah, adding some racing games. Not anything I ever really cared about on the N64 for these two games.
Mm-hmm.
I think Extreme G was probably better on PS2, but...
Yeah, it's weird. Like, I actually have a connection to these. So, you know, this was back when renting games was, like, the main thing. And, yeah, I had an N64, not a PlayStation. So when it came to this stuff, it was pretty interesting. Extreme G, if anything, was, like, sort of an answer to F-Zero. They made a sequel. I don't remember if that game was good at all, but Iggy's Wrecking Balls, you know, a lot of people will say is a fake game. I remember that one very fondly. Yeah, like Chris mentioned, it's a racing game. It's very similar to Sonic, where, you know, it's split screen action, but it's also side scrolling, and it's really all about how much you memorize the race course there. But again, like you're wrecking balls, so it's like there aren't very many ways for them to move, and it's really all about swinging your way across the course. And I just remember the soundtrack being pretty banging, but that was about it. Was it a good game? Probably not, but I definitely had fun with it for the two days that I did play it. So I'll probably just fire it up on my NSO just to see how it goes, and it'll probably be a bad time, but I'm pretty sure I'll be jamming with it.
Yeah, so there are four Extreme G games. They did a second one on the N64 called Extreme G2, and did a third one, Extreme G3, that... I was on PS2 and PS3, and then they did another one called it XGRA, Extreme G Racing Association, mm-hmm. which it had a new weapon system, I guess. So there you go on that. That was on everything. So yeah, Iggy's Wrecking Ball. Okay, mm-hmm. Both these are Acclaim games. So that was not necessarily a sign of quality at that time.
Yeah, they were, you know, they have B games, but this is definitely a lowercase.
Yeah, I think their claim to fame was a lot of the Turok games, and that they ported a lot of Midway games to consoles. This is also the generation where they had the South Park license, where they made some really shitty games on that. So yeah, that's a whole thing there. But yeah, if you had the expansion pack for Nintendo Switch Online, you can check out those games for a little bit. And yeah, there you go. But also on a different subscription service, EA Play, Star Wars Jedi Survivor has been added. I assume this is sort of a taste for people to check out before the price increases here in May, I believe. So yeah, if you have Game Pass Ultimate, or PC Game Pass, or just EA Play on PlayStation, Xbox, or PC, you can check that game out.
Yeah, it was actually sort of a bit of a surprise to me, but then I also realized the game's been out for a year, so it also makes sense.
Yeah. So yeah, that's neat for people that have yet to check it out, but that one's worth checking out. And then we'll get to the showcase for this week. It's happening on Monday. The ID at Xbox Digital Showcase, that they are partnering with IGN on this. It'll be airing at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern time. As they say, it will feature epic trailers, fresh gameplay, and new reveals. We'll see how that one goes. I think they're expecting to be showing off some more Vampire Survivors from what they've hinted at on this. I assume they're going to show off that new DLC that's coming out, the Contra DLC for that. They also have, let's see, Dungeons of Hinterberg. It's a game they've been talking about for a bit. Probably get a date on that. There's 33 Immortals, which is doing a new beta test, I think. So we'll get probably some more on that, as well as, let's see, a game called Lost Records, Bloom and Rage, as well as a bunch of other games. So We'll have to see how that goes and see if this one turns out to be a pretty good show. But yeah, that'll be on here tomorrow morning / afternoon. So there you go for that.
What time is that again?
10 a.m. your time.
Got it. Okay.
Yeah, so there's that. And then we got the big date of the week was Metaphor ReFantazio. Got a release date finally, October 11th for everything, or no, for PlayStation, Xbox, and PC. As well as a new trial, a trailer here. So yeah, that's pretty interesting. That'll be a pretty big fall release. This is the first big new IP out of Atlas in a while. So we'll have to see how that one goes. And they got a big special edition as well. That's $150. You get the game, a steelbook, soundtrack, art book, metallic pins, a sticker sheet, cloth map, some DLC vouchers for costume and BGM DLC, and a digital history book for Atlas's 35th anniversary.
Yep.
Plus an Atlas 35th digital all-time best soundtrack. And yeah, some, and the pre-order bonuses. So that looks like that'll be pretty neat.
Yep.
Yep. I actually sat and watched the event for the full 20, 30 minutes it was on. It definitely didn't need to take that time because I felt like they were just explaining how an RPG works. And I'm pretty sure if you're interested in this game, you pretty much know how an RPG does work, especially an Atlas RPG. And but yeah, like a lot of the stuff they showed was awesome. This is after this, it's definitely like my most anticipated game of the year. And yeah, like if you watch the trailer and you've played any of the modern Personas, whether it be Persona 3 Reload or Persona 5, like you could tell this is absolutely Atlas's work. The UI is totally the same. Character design, obviously, you have the music and soundtrack done by Shoji Meguro, except that it's not, you know, it's not pop or punk anymore. It's just it's more akin to something you'd see in the medieval days, and that's what this game is. This is sort of a medieval / steampunk take on Persona without going to school. So
yep,
I'm on for that,
and I am 100% all for it.
this is not a reason to knock on the game at all. It's totally awesome, and we know what Atlas can do.
And yeah, and I mean, just the freaking like creature design that they showed. It's like, yeah, you can still see.
Yeah. I wouldn't be surprised to see if the final boss be a big dick. It's.
I mean, it probably will be. There will be a giant. If it's in any way related to Persona, there will be a giant penis somewhere. It is pretty much guaranteed.
But yeah, like a lot of the similarities in battle system, even like they're talking about, oh, you have archetypes and you can go ahead and change classes and they'll change your moves. I'm like, those are Personas, totally Persona. But yeah, that's not a reason to not be excited. If anything, I am more excited for it, especially after finishing Reload. Like I am down for like this year, as far as like, you know, Twitter or X, whatever you want to call it, has been talking about like there being sort of, it's been slow in gaming. Like, no, it hasn't. If you play the RPG genre, it definitely, we've had Yakuza, we've had two Final Fantasies in the last 6 months, we've had Persona 3 Reload, we're gonna have Fantasio, we're gonna have a Trails game. There's a new Saga game that came out on Friday that, you know, none of us talked about. Like, that's how busy it is right now. Crazy.
Yeah. So yeah, there's that. That'll be one of the big Japanese releases of the fall. And yeah, we got another game here that'll be out this fall. We got our first trailer and sort of gameplay details of it. Tales of the Shire. The Lords of the Ring game. That's a little weird name, but okay. That'll be on everything, PS5, Xbox Series X and S, Switch, and PC this fall from Private Division, the publisher, and the developers Weta Workshop. This is basically a life sim set in the small hobbit town of Bywater. It says here, though not yet established as an official village in Hobbiton, play a big part in helping the quaint town flourish. Bring comfort at the door as you decorate your own hobbit hole, tend to your garden, fish at the clear ponds, forage wild fruits and herbs, trade with townsfolk, prepare homemade meals to share with fellow hobbits and foster relationships. So very much a chill Lord of the Rings game, essentially, where what happened to the people, the hobbits that were left behind by Frodo and the gang? And it's like, oh, they still had a good time because it seemed like Ward never got to them from the end of those movies. So they probably had some decent times.
These hobbits were definitely living in peace. But yeah, I don't really care for the Lord of the Rings franchise, but this cozy game definitely does look fun.
Yeah. So yeah, that'll be out this fall. No date on it yet, but the first bits here looks pretty solid for that. So there you go. Well, let's start getting to some other news, more negative news here. BlizzCon 2024 has been canceled. They've basically said they are, let's see, they're as excited as ever to bring BlizzCon back in future years. Saying after careful consideration over the last year, we at Blizzard have made a decision to not hold BlizzCon in 2024. I imagine a lot of this is getting all the details ironed out after the acquisition, probably leaving them a little time to kind of get a show here ready for the various Blizzard teams. Because like the only things it seems like they would be able to show likely would be the new expansion for World of Warcraft and maybe a Diablo 4 expansion, but other than that, not really a ton going on there at the moment. So yeah, this seems like probably a smart idea. Maybe come back next year with a full slate of things to get people excited for.
Yeah, I mean, aside from the fact that they've announced nothing but bad news over the past year and a half, I'm wondering like what kind of focus a BlizzCon can have, because normally they use BlizzCon to talk about all the new things happening with all their games, but looking back at Overwatch 2 where they took out the single player campaign stuff that they wanted to work on, as nice launch as it had, it's also slowed down in the live ops department. Also I think almost all the community managers for Blizzard were laid off because Microsoft already had some, and then now I see that they're opening some temporary roles. Yeah, like BlizzCon is important to the Blizzard community, but if there is no like people leaving the community, it's going to be a little hard there. So yeah, I'll be interested in seeing how it tries to even talk about the future. Obviously we have some head honchos at definitely do know what they're doing, and they do know what it'll take to put this sort of event up, but it'll be hard to see what the future looks like when a lot of the things they've announced for the past few months.
Yep. So yeah. We'll have to see how things are for a 2025 show, but for now they're going to take a break on the event stuff. But yeah, let's get to the next one here. Nintendo, back in, when was this? 2020.
Yeah.
Fortnite was getting some big additions to their skin stuff with Sony letting Kratos appear on there, as well as Microsoft with Master Chief. Kind of allowing these big platform characters kind of be playable in this cross-platform game so that people on a Nintendo Switch or Xbox could play with the PlayStation character Kratos or, people on PlayStation or Switch playing with Master Chief and all that. The scuttle around them was that Nintendo would be allowing a Samus Aran on there as well. That would fit pretty well in that game, but that never ended up happening. And it seems like we now know some more about that, thanks to Stephen Totillo's newsletter, Gamefile, as he revealed that Nintendo did not want their characters on other platforms. So that's very much like a big no-go on Fortnite stuff. Is that it's generally got to be available on all the platforms. As they said here from Donald Mustard, who is the creative director on the game, they got really hung up on their characters showing up on platforms that weren't their platforms. They'd be thrilled to have Nintendo characters in Fortnite, but just only if it's on their platform. Nintendo request for Switch exclusivity for Samus met a red line of Epic's own. Donald Mustard saying, for me and for all of Epic, we're like, that is an absolute must. We want to make sure Fortnite is the same experience, no matter what screen or device you're playing on. And yeah, that's not too surprising. Nintendo would really get held up on wanting only people on their platform being able to play as their characters. That would be the big issue. So yeah, that's unsurprising why it ended up not happening.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it makes sense, but it's dumb. But it makes sense, but it's dumb. That's all I have to say about it.
Yeah.
Mm.
So yeah, there you go. Nintendo very much not wanting to get more people on board with Metroid.
Yep.
As you know, they continue to struggle to get Metroid Prime 4 out there.
Yeah.
As they've had to restart the development on that a handful of years ago.
Yep.
And it seems like it's going to miss the entire generation.
Maybe.
At this point. So yeah, there you go on that. So at least there's plenty more characters to play with in Fortnite.
Oh yeah.
But let's get to some Atari news. They are reviving a publishing label Infogrames.
Mm-hmm.
The French label that, if you don't remember this, when Dragon Ball Z games got big, that was on the Atari label.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a very weird thing to remember.
Yeah.
you know, Dragon Ball Z, the hit Atari property.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, the part of that was Infogrames bought the Atari property and all that at a certain point, because they also published like the driver games on the PS1 that did really well, as well as a number of other games. But it seems like that's still a part of the Atari IP. And so Atari is using that as a new publishing label for all the non-Atari games. As they say here, Infogrames intends to actively manage its catalog of titles by expanding digital and physical distribution, developing new collections and sequels, as well as managing their games that fall outside Atari's core portfolio of intellectual property.
Mm-hmm.
So that's probably anything that isn't like a classic Atari property for that. And I guess also mentioning that game preservation is a core component of its mission, which I don't know necessarily what that means. It's a term that a lot of companies have been using of late as like a marketing term, and I don't know that they actually mean what it actually means.
Mm.
So I think Xbox mentioned they were starting up a team that seems likely designed around making sure their games play well if they're moving over to new architecture for the next Xbox. But also mentioned game preservation, and that seems like it's only meant as a means of preserving the games that they have gotten, you know, working in backwards compatibility, and not necessarily actual preservation, which is the stuff that like the Video Game History Foundation does and various other groups do, which is actually preserving games to be accessible for the long term, not just when they're commercially viable. So this, I assume this is mainly about game preservation as a financial viability thing versus what it actually means. But yeah, they'll be seemingly doing more publishing stuff. And I guess as part of this, they purchased the developer and the rights to the game Totally Reliable Delivery Service, which is on all the consoles and PC. So that was previously published by Tiny Build, but now Atari and Infogrames have purchased that all right up. So pretty interesting new initiative for them.
Mm.
Yeah, really weird. First of all, it's pronounced Infogrames, but nobody cares because whatever. Yeah, as you mentioned, they published a lot of the Dragon Balls before Atari fully took over. Well, didn't really take over the company. But yeah, the reason why like this rings a bell to me is because a long time ago, Infogrames had a very corny 90s style theme song that was kind of like a corporate anthem, and it's like so bad it's good. So yeah, I left a link to it on the Discord, and yeah, it's terrible if and when you decide to listen to it. But yeah, I remember Infogrames specifically because I was a big fan of the Dragon Ball Z Legacy of Goku RPGs on the Game Boy Advance. Those were like, you know, I was in my Golden Sun Breath of Fire phase, and when I saw Dragon Ball Z like 1, 2, and 3, you know, I had to play them all, and that's the only reason why I remember these.
Yeah. So yeah, there you go. Atari's doing something interesting.
Yeah.
And sort of building up their publishing label here for non-Atari stuff, basically.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, speaking of publishers, Embracer Group, they've been in a lot of financial hot water for the last couple of years.
Yeah, that's kind of that's one way to put it. Yeah.
Yeah, and they have announced their new plan here, as they seem to at least claim to be doing better, in a better space where they're hopefully not laying off tons of people constantly. But they have announced they are splitting into three individual publicly traded companies that are still under the same ownership. And yeah, they'll be run individually and traded publicly in the market, with IP and franchises under the Embracer Group umbrella spread across them.
Mm-hmm.
They have announced all the names. I think this one's the one that will potentially be changing at some point. There's Middle Earth Enterprises and Friends, which, as they say here, is intended to remain a creative powerhouse in AAA game development and publishing for PC/console. It reigns the stewards of the Lord of the Rings and Tomb Raider IPs, with its main focus being on the former. It will consist of studios like Crystal Dynamics, Dam Buster Studios, Eidos Montreal, Flying Wild Hog Studios, Tripwire, Vertigo Games, Warhorse Studios, 4A Games, and more, with IPs including Dead Island, Killing Floor, Kingdom Come Deliverance, The Lord of the Rings, Metro, and Tomb Raider. Which the 4A and Metro stuff seems a little bit new, because we thought they had been, at least the developer had been acquired in the Saber stuff, that when they bought themselves out from Embracer Group. So maybe that wasn't the case. But there you go. For your big budget games, that'll be published under the Middle Earth Enterprises and Friends label. That may change at some point for that. Let's see. The next one, Coffee Stain and Friends. This one is intended to consist of leading publishers and developers focused on a variety of games for PC, console, mobile, including community-driven free-to-play games, live ops games, and indie/AA games. Operate under two segments, according to the company, premium and free-to-play. And the premium operations includes studios like Coffee Stain, Ghost Ship, Tarsier, Tuxedo Labs, THQ Nordic, and Amplifier Game Invest. And those IPs include Deep Rock Galactic, Goat Simulator, Satisfactory, Wreckfest, Teardown, Valheim, and more than 200 others.
Yeah.
Free-to-play operations include studios like Easy Brain, Deca, Crazy Labs, and Cryptic, with IPs including Sudoku.com, Blaku Doku, Jigsaw Puzzle, Star Trek Online, D&D Neverwinter Online, and more. So there you go for that stuff. And the last one, Asmodee. Asmodee consists of 23 fully owned studios and more than 300 IPs, and consists of the tabletop games section of Embracer Group. We'll continue focusing on tabletop properties while collaborating with in transmedia partnerships for IPs like The Lord of the Rings and others in the Embracer wheelhouse. As a global leader in board and trading card games, with a proven track record of profitable growth, Asmodee is well positioned to build on its strategy and continue to prosper as a standalone entity. And so that one includes IPs like Ticket to Ride, Seven Wonders, Azul, Catan, Dabble, Exploding Kittens, and other board games based on The Lord of the Rings, Marvel, Game of Thrones, Netflix, Lego, and Star Wars. So, boy.
Yeah.
This seems like another big name change to kind of get people off the trail of these companies, as they used to be known as THQ Nordic. Then they decided in a bright move to do an AMA on 8chan, and that backfired pretty well for them, to the degree that they ended up changing the name of that overall company from THQ Nordic to Embracer Group. And now with all this shit, it seems like they are breaking up that company into three groups, so that Embracer Group no longer is a thing. Instead, it's all these dumb names. Middle Earth Enterprises and Friends. And Coffee Stain and Friends. And Asmodee's at least a name. It's been around for a while, so... But yeah, that's an interesting structure they're going with, trying to spin these off into different companies that at least the ones that are a bit more more efficient can prosper, while the other ones maybe have more potential for big gains, but maybe have some opportunities for misses and all that. So yeah, this is an interesting way to go. Maybe not the greatest, because then you now have new brands that need to be pushed, and it's like do all these games under the Middle Earth Enterprises and Friends get published under that name, or do they have different names? Because I think Kingdom Come Deliverance 2 just got announced last week to be published under PlayOn, and I guess that doesn't exist anymore. We don't really know the details on that stuff, but yeah. It just adds more names to add to your sketchy list of companies to avoid if you can.
Yeah, well, I mean, if anything, it's not bad news. There's that going for it. But, you know, these three companies are, they all have the same CEO. I don't know if that means this guy has more or less work. I would assume that, you know, being a CEO is a lot of work. So now instead of being a CEO of one company, he's a CEO of three. And he's already gone through all sorts of heat, and he's still going to continue to go through it. And, you know, we're talking about Middle Earth, Abla and Friends or whatever. There aren't a whole lot of Lord of the Rings games that to, and the one that we talked about today is being published by Take-Two. Yeah, that's pretty much all I got here.
Yeah. But yeah, I believe also part of this is that the CEO, Lars Wingefors, is also at least part owner, if not full owner. He's a co-founder of the company, so he gets to stay on for as long as I guess he wants.
Mm-hmm.
There's been a lot of talk from him, as people are very critical of his work and how he's, you know, caused a lot of job losses and all that, and very much trying to shift that from him being the cause of that to other things. And he's just trying as best as he can, and it's like, that's not really what stockholders like to hear. They want concrete plans that will make them money, and not just people hoping to make hoping plans to get money from the Saudis, you know, go through, or else everything is in shit. So yeah. Well, yeah, there you go. There's your Embracer Group news of the week, and that will have new names to call the various products they make here in the future. So yeah, there you go. Yeah, I think that will end up doing it for this week.
All right. Awesome.
Yeah. Thank you to Brandon and Danner for joining this week.
Always.
We'll be back next week with a new slate of news and a new month.
Yep.
I think the big thing we got releasing this week is Endless Ocean Luminous on the Switch. So we'll see how that one goes.
Yeah.
But otherwise, we still got a bunch of games coming out that have been coming out that we'll get more time into. I'll get past that intro and Ayuden Chronicle 100 Heroes and get some more stuff in Another Crab's Treasure. Maybe beat Tales of Kinzera Zao. We'll see. But yeah, thank you all for tuning in. If you enjoy the show, for let friends and family know.
Yeah.
To check it out and select strangers that are also excited about all the games that have been coming out.
Oh God, there have been so many.
So yeah, thank you all for tuning in. Hope you have a good week ahead. We will see you all next time. Have a good one.